Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a really pivotal moment in photography, this huge philosophical split in the early 20th century.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We're basically tracking how photography went from trying its hardest not to look like a photograph.
Right, trying to be painting.
Exactly. Trying to mimic painting, aiming for this soft, romantic feel, to suddenly embracing what the camera actually does best.
Yeah.
Capture reality with, well, startling clarity.
So our mission today is to unpack that shift. We'll dig into the sources that show us pictorialism, that painterly dream, and then contrast it with the stark realism of straight photography.
It all started because early photographers were desperate for legitimacy, weren't they? They felt the need to, you know, art up the medium to get it accepted alongside painting.
Which led to this crucial fork in the road. We've got sources detailing both sides, key figures, key images. We'll look at pictorialism, the transition with someone like Stieglitz, and then the arrival of uncompromising clarity with folks like Group F64.
Should be quite a journey.
Okay, so let's dive into pictorialism first. Late 19th, early 20th century. If you were a pictorialist photographer, what was your main goal? What drove you?
The main drive was really aesthetics over accuracy. The idea was, how can I make this look like a painting or a drawing? Beauty, atmosphere, mood, that was the priority.
Not just capturing what was there.
Definitely not. They wanted to elevate it, idealize it, and crucially, they wanted to show the artist's hand to counter that idea of the camera as just a cold mechanical recorder.
Mm-hmm.
So manual intervention was key.
Okay, so how did they achieve that look? What are the visual tell? If I see a photo from this era, how do I know it's pictorialist?
Well, the big one is soft focus. It immediately takes away that sharp documentary feel. Then you've got lots of manipulation, often in the dark room.
Like what kind of manipulation?
Things like complex printing processes. They weren't just making simple prints. They used techniques like gum bichromate, platinum prints, photogravure, processes that allowed for tonal control, texture, a kind of velvety quality. It looks less like a snapshot, more like a charcoal sketch or an etching sometimes.
So very deliberate, very crafted.
Absolutely. Every step was about adding that artistic layer, ensuring it didn't look machine-made.
Let's make this concrete. Gertrude Kesbier's The Manger from 1899 often comes up. How does that fit the pictorialist mold?
Oh, it's a perfect example. First off, it's staged. She's got her friend dressed up, posed in a stable setting, holding this bundle. It immediately evokes religious painting, like a nativity scene.
But it's photography.
Right. But look how she handles it. The focus is soft. There's this luminous, almost hazy quality to the light. It feels ethereal, dreamlike. It's not sharp documentation at all.
And the subject itself isn't literal, is it? She obscures the model's face, uses swaddling instead of an actual baby.
Precisely. And that lifts it beyond just a portrait or a genre scene. It becomes symbolic. It's about the idea of motherhood, this universal theme, presented in a very delicate, almost sacred way.
And that softness, the atmosphere, that wasn't just how the light fell.
No, no. The sources are clear that the soft focus, the vignetting, you know, where the corners darken, drawing your eye to the center, those were choices made during the printing process, likely using that platinum print method. It allowed her to really control the mood and assert her artistic vision. It screams artist's hand.
It's kind of amazing to think that was the dominant artistic approach for photography. But like you said, things started to shift. And Alfred Stieglitz is central to that shift, right? But he didn't start out as Mr. Clarity.
Not at all. Stieglitz was a giant of pictorialism initially. Hugely influential, both as a photographer and as a promoter, through his galleries and publications like Camera Work.
So what did his pictorialist work look like? We have the Flatiron from 1903 as an example.
Yes. The Flatiron is classic Stieglitz in that period. It shows the famous New York building, but it's shot on a snowy, misty day. The whole scene is bathed in this soft, atmospheric light. The building's edges aren't sharp. It sort of looms out of the haze.
Very moody, very painterly.
Exactly. And the printing method he often used for this, photogravure, enhances that.
Right. You mentioned photogravure earlier. Tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. Photogravure is an intaglio printing process, like etching. The image is etched onto a copper plate, which is then inked and printed. It gives you really rich, deep blacks and subtle tones, often with a slightly warm, velvety look. It's perfect for that impressionistic, romantic feeling he was going for in the Flatiron.
But something changed for him, that soft, moody aesthetic. It stopped being enough.
Yeah, around the mid-1900s, maybe a bit later, he started to feel that pictorialism was, well, he called it decorative softness. He began to think that photography's real power, its unique contribution, wasn't in imitating painting, but in its ability to capture the world with incredible clarity and precision.
Something no other art form could do in quite the same way.
Exactly. He felt photographers were shying away from the medium's inherent strength. Why make a photograph look fuzzy when its nature is to be sharp?
And this change in thinking comes to a head with the steerage in 1907. That photo feels worlds away from the Flatiron.
It really does. The steerage is seen as this landmark moment, a pivot towards modernism in photography. He took it on a ship, looking down at the passengers in the lower-class steerage section.
But it wasn't just about documenting their conditions, was it?
Not primarily, though that's part of its power. What struck Stieglitz, according to his own account, was the composition he saw. He saw the lines, the diagonal slant of the gangway, the round funnel, the stairs, the patterns made by the people. It was a spontaneous arrangement of shapes and forms.
So form over feeling, almost. Or rather, finding the art in the form itself.
Yes. Instead of creating a mood with soft focus, he's finding aesthetic power in the sharp geometry of the scene. The clarity, the structure, the interplay of shapes. That's what excited him. He apparently rushed to get his camera to capture it before the people moved.
Which must have been tricky with the cameras back then.
Absolutely. Large format, slow process. It required quick thinking and technical skill. He later said, the steerage was the image that showed him what photography could be, a perfect fusion of documentary reality and abstract formal beauty.
Okay, so Stieglitz points the way. How did this idea of clarity and honesty become a full-blown movement? Let's talk straight photography. What's the core principle?
The name says it all, straight. It fundamentally means photographs that are not manipulated, especially on the negative. No retouching, no adding fuzzy effects in the darkroom to make it look painterly.
So embracing the camera's nature.
Completely. The goal was a direct, honest portrayal of the world. Sharp focus, clear details, high contrast, realism. It was about celebrating what the lens could see, not apologizing for it.
And Paul Strand was a key figure in pushing this aesthetic early on, right?
Definitely. Strand really championed sharp focus and objective representation. Look at his photo, Wall Street, from 1915.
Yes, the one with the huge Morgan Bank building and the tiny figures walking past.
That's the one. It's fascinating because it combines documentary, it's literally Wall Street, with a very modern abstract sensibility. He uses the strong geometric shapes of the building's windows and the long, dark shadows cast by the people.
The people almost become graphic elements, like dark slashes against the building.
Exactly. They're reduced to silhouettes, part of the overall formal pattern. It's using the camera's sharp clarity to create this powerful, almost intimidating, abstract composition from a real scene.
And he took it even further towards pure form.
He did. With abstraction, Porch Shadows in 1916. This one is often called one of the first truly straight abstract photographs. It's literally just the shadows of a porch railing falling onto a round table.
No recognizable subject beyond shapes.
Pretty much. He focuses entirely on the sharp geometric forms, the triangles, the lines, the curves created by the light and shadow.
Mm.
It's about seeing the abstract potential in the everyday, captured directly and sharply by the camera. No manipulation, just framing and focus.
This commitment to sharpness and clarity needed a banner, a group, to really push it forward. That brings us to Group F64, founded in California in the 30s.
That's right, 1932, San Francisco Bay Area. And they were explicitly formed to promote straight photography against the lingering influence of pictorialism.
And the name, F64, that's a camera setting, isn't it?
It is. It refers to a very small aperture setting on the lens, typically used on large format cameras. And the reason they chose it is because a small aperture like F64 gives you the greatest possible depth of field.
Meaning everything is in sharp focus, from foreground to background.
Exactly. Maximum sharpness, maximum detail. The name itself was a manifesto. It symbolized their belief in the camera as this incredibly precise instrument capable of observing the world with unadulterated clarity.
So who are the key players in Group F64 and what did their work look like? Edward Weston comes to mind immediately.
Weston is absolutely central. He was a co-founder and perhaps the master of finding monumental form in ordinary objects. Think of his close-ups of shells or vegetables.
The pepper. Pepper number 30 from 1930. It's iconic.
It is. He took a simple green pepper, put it inside a tin funnel to control the light, and photographed it with such intense focus and carefully modulated light that it becomes this incredible sculptural form. It's sensual abstract yet utterly real and sharply detailed. You see every curve, every highlight.
It looks carved out of light and shadow. Now, this raises a point about no manipulation. Weston's prints are famously beautiful with deep blacks and luminous highlights. That didn't just happen automatically, did it?
No, and this is a crucial distinction. The no manipulation rule primarily applied to the negative. You didn't scratch it, draw on it, or combine negatives. The negative was considered a pure record.
But the print?
The print was where technique came in to ensure the final image accurately represented the full range of tones captured on the negative. The dynamic range of light in reality is far greater than photographic paper can handle straight. So they used darkroom techniques like dodging, holding back light from certain areas to make them lighter, and burning, giving extra light to other areas to make them darker.
So they were manipulating the print, but the goal wasn't to change the image's content or make it fuzzy.
Exactly. The goal was technical perfection, to make the print a faithful, optimized translation of what the negative recorded. It was about controlling the tones to match the pre-visualized image, not about adding artificial effects. It's manipulation for fidelity, if you like.
That makes sense, like mastering your instrument. Who else was key in F64? Imogen Cunningham.
Yes, Imogen Cunningham, another co-founder. She also had an earlier pictorialist phase, but her F64 work is known for its sharp, elegant botanical studies, like Magnolia Blossom from 1925. Incredible detail, beautiful forms, very precise.
And then there's Ansel Adams, probably the most famous name associated with the group.
Adams, yes. His majestic landscapes of the American West are maybe the ultimate expression of F64's clarity and tonal control. Think of Monolith, the face of Half Dome from 1927.
That incredible shot with the stark white snow against the dark rock and the almost black sky. How did he achieve that level of drama and contrast within the straight philosophy?
Well, Adams was a master technician and pioneered the zone system for controlling exposure and development to achieve a specific tonal range in the final print. But for that dramatic sky and Monolith, a key decision happened before he even prints the shutter.
What was that?
He used a filter. Normally, photographers might use a yellow filter to darken a blue sky slightly. Adams realized that wouldn't give him the intense drama he wanted, so he used a strong red filter. A red filter blocks blue light dramatically, rendering a blue sky very dark, almost black, making the white clouds or snow pop.
Ah, so that choice was made in camera, affecting what light hit the negative.
Correct. It's an optical manipulation at the point of capture, not a darkroom alteration of the negative's content later. It fits within the straight photography ethos because the negative is still an unadulterated record of the light that passed through the chosen filter. It's about using the tools of photography with precision to achieve a pre-visualized result.
So this shift from the dreamy haze of pictorialism to the sharp focus of straight photography, what was its lasting impact? Where did it lead?
Oh, it fundamentally shaped the future of photography. By establishing the camera's own aesthetic language, one based on clarity, detail, and realism, straight photography laid the groundwork for so many genres that followed.
Like documentary photography.
Absolutely. Yeah. The belief in the camera's ability to record reality truthfully, even powerfully, is essential for documentary work. Think of Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother from 1936. While there are debates about its context, its visual power relies on that sense of direct, unvarnished reality pioneered by straight photography.
And street photography, too.
Yes, very much so. Henri Cartier-Bresson's whole idea of the decisive moment, capturing that fleeting instant where geometry, subject, and meaning align, perfectly relies on the camera's speed and sharpness, the very quality street photography celebrated.
It's fascinating how that debate echoes today, even with digital tools. You know, how much do you correct an image versus how much do you let the raw capture speak? That tension between manipulation and clarity is still right there.
It absolutely is. It's the fundamental question. Is the photographer primarily an observer, faithfully recording, or an interpreter, actively shaping?
Which leads us to a final thought for you, our listeners, to consider. We've talked about straight photography's philosophy of no manipulation, especially of the negative.
Right, the ideal of the pure, unadulterated image.
But then we look at masterpieces of the movement. Weston's Pepper Nom 30 needed meticulous burning and dodging in the darkroom to achieve its final form. That's manipulation of the print, even if to achieve fidelity.
And later, even iconic documentary photos that inherited this aesthetic, like Lange's Migrant Mother. It's known that the negative was actually retouched back in the 30s to remove a visually distracting element, the subject's thumb holding a tent pole in the corner.
So if the defining examples involved significant print work and even occasional negative retouching crept into its legacy, was pure, unmanipulated, straight photography ever truly achievable in practice? Or was it more of an artistic ideal, a guiding principle that demanded technical mastery rather than absolute literal purity? Something to think about.